Welcome to How to Money. I'm Joel.
And I am Matt.
And today we are explaining why these financial rules were made to be broken.
So Joel, as you said that, it made me realize that this is an episode that I don't want listeners to listen to if they have never listened to our show before. Because
we're not putting this episode under the start here section of our
website. No, exactly. Yeah, this is like a 2000 level class at your local university. We want to make sure that folks have truly like a foundation of knowledge when it comes to personal finances. Because in this episode, we're going to talk about some concepts. And we're essentially going to flip them on their head a little bit, because we're making the argument that you can't take all the different financial rules that are out there at face value. We're going to ask you to dig a little bit deeper, and we're going to explain why it is that we feel that there are certain financial rules that we can break.
Yeah, we're going to talk about where you can fight back and where you can fight the man, you know, a little bit when it comes to the financial rules that we have all heard. Like these are common rules that you have probably heard a time or two or dozens of times, and some of them, there's certainly a kernel of truth. There's some good advice in there, but there are a lot of ways that you can break those rules and actually benefit your personal finances.
That's right, exactly. Before we get to that, dude, I wanted to share a quick little story with you. Kate and I were on a belated anniversary trip. We were driving back from North Carolina. We went hiking up in the North Carolina mountains.
There you go. And you spotted a bear while you were there too.
I did.
We should post that video.
Should
on Instagram.
I share that video?
Yeah, two bears, a mama and a cub. And I'm glad
the cub was cute, but we quickly realized that there was a mama bear that was closely following.
I was glad you didn't go like Leonardo in The Revenant style.
Without my pocket knife? No, Kate would not have let me do that. That would have been a bad ending to our anniversary, one of our anniversary hikes. But I was going to share, driving back from North Carolina, it was obvious there was a car up ahead of us that we're catching up to. It was all decked out in the we just got married kind of look. You know what I'm talking about.
The cans hitting the road and stuff.
No
like
cans.
That.
I think that's dangerous, actually. but they
sparks flying.
Cans hitting windshields behind them. No, they had the window paint, and it said, you know, just married, you know, Mr. and Mrs. whatever their names were. I forget. That's always a super fun thing to do, right? You know, I guess they're driving to their honeymoon. They looked all happy, ready to get on with their lives together. But something else that we noticed that was also written on the window was their Venmo handle, their name. And I couldn't believe it when I saw it. I was like, wait, what? And I realized that I guess they were hoping that folks driving down the interstate might see that, might want to congratulate them, might want to pass them some money in order to help them celebrate a little bit. But before I share my thoughts, what do you think? Is that frugal? Is that cheap? Is that a tasteful move? Or do you feel like that lacks class?
I'm going to say it's clever. I don't know if it's frugal or cheap, but it's clever because I think there are a lot of people who are going to see that driving down the side of the road, and they are going to remember their wedding day, and they're going to remember all the excitement, and they're going to be compelled to drop 15, 20, 30 bucks, maybe more.
Oh, you think
who
so?
Knows?
Oh,
I don't know. Gosh. Maybe some people would just be like, "Congrats, you guys made my day. That was pretty funny." I will, because it's almost to me like when I'm walking through downtown Atlanta and I see someone like a homeless person who has a clever sign, like with a joke on it or something like that, it makes me more compelled to give. And I don't know what that is, but when they've kind of like
just
made me
that,
smile,
you appreciate that creativity.
Yeah, I'm like, I like the creativity, and I'm like, all right, yeah, here's $5, you know. So I don't know. It's not like everyone's doing it. It's kind of a one-off thing. I'm like, oh yeah, that is cool. I give him $10.
Okay, so I kind of revealed, I guess, how I feel about it, because I truly when I first saw it, I couldn't believe it. I was honestly a little bit offended, because I have such like a pull yourself up by your bootstraps, like self-reliance kind of mentality, that literally when I saw it, I just couldn't. I thought, you got to be kidding me. Like, they're actually expecting people to give them money just because they got married. How dare they? That was like the old man side of me. But then
get off my lawn, Matt.
Yeah. But then I thought, well, why not? You know, like, I think it would be maybe lacking taste if they expected you to give them money, but like there's no
like
harm.
Give to this Venmo or else.
Yeah, no, and they weren't doing that. It was just kind of written on there as like almost like an afterthought, and it was much smaller than what else was written up there. And what's the worst that could happen, right? I mean, somebody driving down the road like me might see them and like judge them and never see them again. Who cares? But it never hurts to ask.
It's like what we've talked about when it comes to asking for a discount.
Exactly.
And like the downside. What's the downside? We're all so scared to make that ask. But really, the person can only say no. They're not going to like punch you in the face usually.
Exactly. So. And so because of that, I was kind of like converted right there on the spot. And so I pushed him $5.
Did you?
Yeah.
See? Oh, give me a dap, dude.
Little punch there.
Okay. I like that. See, I probably would have done the same if I had seen it.
Because it took me a second, though, because my natural inclination was just like, you got to be kidding me.
You went through all the realm of emotion.
Yeah. That was the journey of me and seeing some newlyweds on the interstate. But, I thought that was an interesting, clever way. So if there are any newlyweds out there, that could be a way that you maybe pay for a nice dinner out.
There you go.
On your honeymoon.
Yeah, make it fun, though. Make it fun. And people will, I think, probably be excited to drop you $5, like Matt finally got to the point of doing. All right, let's mention the beer that we're having on this episode. This one is called Indefinite Staycation. It's by Dogfish Head Brewing. Matt, my buddy Ryan, brought this beer back from Delaware. He actually visited the brewery. He goes up there once a year, and he's always like nice enough to bring us a bottle back. So big thanks to Ryan for dropping this one off. We actually shared a beer together while he gave it to me. And looking forward to drinking this. This is like a really nice looking sour beer. So.
This is, it came corked and caged.
Uh-huh.
Is that what it's called?
Oh, it's a fancy kind, yeah.
Yeah, one of those fancier beers. So. Looking forward to this. And thank you, Ryan, for donating this one to Joel, therefore to me as well.
We'll give our thoughts on it at the end of the episode. But let's get on to the subject at hand, financial rules that were made to be broken. And Matt, speaking of going on a drive, seeing people on the interstate with their just married signs up, I'm wondering if any How to Money listeners out there are the type that always obey the speed limits. I don't know that I've necessarily met anybody in my life who can claim to never have ever gone over the speed limit, but maybe some of those people exist. And I guess like, do you consistently try to drive under the speed limit of the sign that you're seeing? If so, I think you are an anomaly. Like that is not...
Yeah, you're a robot if that's the case.
Exactly. So I'm of the belief, and maybe some of our listeners will disagree, but speed limits were kind of made to be broken. And I'm just trying to be honest here. And I'm not trying to insinuate that any of us should be reaching like formula level one speeds that my 06 minivan, I'm going to go like 120 on the interstate or anything like that.
Do you think Homer can reach those speeds?
I think so.
I think so? Okay.
I think so. Yeah, he's still got some fight left in him. But even like in a 55 mile per hour zone, I often find myself going 65 miles an hour. And I don't think I've met a person yet who never breaks that rule. And it's not that rules aren't helpful, right? That the speed limit isn't helpful. We like rules, and speed limits, I think, are overall a good thing. And these financial rules that we're going to talk about, well, they can aid us on our financial journey. And there are some times when we need to rev the engine and blow past not just the sign that says 55 miles an hour, but also we have to blow past some of the financial rules that we've heard our entire lives that are maybe cramping our style and not allowing us to make as much progress as we'd otherwise like to make.
Totally. Yeah. When we believe, that the rules are just black and white, it can limit what we're able to get done, and not only in our day-to-day lives, but also with our money. So kind of going back to your example, if you're driving 65 instead of 55, that just means that you'll be able to arrive at the mountains or maybe the beach a little bit sooner. And we'd also argue that you can break this rule while still being responsible, still driving safely. And so similarly, there's a lot of financial advice out there. Some would even call them rules that are, etched into stone as if they can never be broken, where we believe a certain amount of liberty can be taken. So we're going to cover some of those rules as well as why it's okay to be a conscientious objector to some of these financial rules. And we're going to give you the basically the ammunition that's going to inform you why it's okay to break some of these rules.
Yeah. We want to give the why behind it, not just be like, this one's crap, toss it out. Yeah. But give you kind of the ideas for then how you proceed, creating maybe a new framework for how you think about it so that you're not just living your life by rigid rules, but that you have a fuller picture and understanding of kind of how they should be implemented into your life, or maybe, where they shouldn't be. And so let's start, Matt, with some of the rules maybe that get a little judgy when it comes to how we live our personal lives. A few lifestyle rules are often cited, and then people begin to live their lives by these rules, often subconsciously. They get filtered in, and then we just assume that we have to react this way because that's what the rules say.
Right.
And then those rules can cause us to put off important and meaningful things in our lives because we've been led to believe that we're not in the financial position to make those decisions for ourselves. And I think, Matt, one of those rules that I have heard stated countless times is that you shouldn't get married or start a family unless you are financially prepared to do so. And that sounds like a smart rule, doesn't it? It's like, yeah, you don't want to have, you know, negative net worth to your name by hundreds of thousands of dollars and then get married and attach yourself to someone else who has the same. Like, I get why this rule is held out there as fact. But you don't have to have necessarily a fully funded emergency fund in order to get married to the love of your life. Like, there is no actual rule stating this. There's no rule that you have to own a home. Or
maybe you can put that emergency fund together while you're driving down the interstate.
Exactly.
Right after you got married.
Have other people fund it for you.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and there's also no rule that you must have started saving for retirement before you tie the knot. Getting married, you do so because you love somebody else. You love that person that you want to spend the rest of your life with. And so we wouldn't say to not consider money at all when you're thinking about tying the knot. We're fans of premarital counseling and getting what's called financially naked by like revealing kind of what's going on with your personal finances and your credit score before you actually do get married.
Yeah, you need to be honest and you need to share, you know, what your income is. If you have any debts, these are all things that don't need to be a surprise.
Yes.
You know, you don't need to save those until after you get married. Do talk about these things ahead of time, but things just don't have to be perfect.
Exactly. Yeah. Don't think that you have to continue to push that wedding date down the road
right
until you've reached like the most stringent financial goals possible. And I think it's important to note that nobody actually feels financially ready for these things. Like, you don't get to this point where you're like, ah, now I have enough money and we're going to live in wedded bliss because we've reached the financial status that we were looking to achieve. This is one of those things I feel like is important to push back on and not to be stupid when it comes to getting married and spending tons of money on a wedding when you are in massive amounts of debt. You want to be thoughtful, but it's also important not to continue to put it off because you don't feel like you're quite in the financial position you want to be in.
Yeah, there's always going to be another problem, right? Because if you have, say you've amassed a pretty decent net worth and you're looking to get married, well then all sorts of other questions start coming up that you have to grapple with, as opposed to before when you were both broke right out of college. Things were a lot simpler back then, weren't they?
Yep.
And so, you know, Joel, you mentioned family. I think likewise, like bringing kids into the world, if you've got massive amounts of debt and maybe little to no income, that doesn't make much sense. It's going to be really hard to give them the care that they need if you can't afford diapers, whether you're talking about disposable or cloth diapers. And similar to getting married, it always feels like a stretch to start having kids. I think in many ways, you're completely unprepared for it. And there's nothing that you could have actually done to fully prepare for having kids. It's like having kids.
Similarly, it'd be like saying you have to read all these parenting books before you begin having kids. And I'm not against parenting books. I've read a couple myself. But even those, like, they don't really prepare you for having kids. And so, yeah, it's probably helpful advice to say read a parenting book or two, but it's also like, you don't have to before you have kids.
Exactly. And when it comes to the money, like, it's important maybe to talk to another friend who is, you know, maybe has a kid who's a year old or 2 years old and be like, hey, how much did it cost you?
Yeah.
How much do you now spend going to the doctor? These are all good things to be aware of. And that's something you can figure out in a 15-minute conversation. You don't have to spend, you know, an entire semester going through your own child rearing class, based on reading books. And so having some of your financial ducks in a row before you start trying to bring kiddos into the world is smart. Don't, you know, get us wrong. Like, we do think that it is worth preparing for a little bit. But don't let this rule cause you to over prepare and wait too long when you really, you know, maybe you want to get that family started now. And by kicking that down the road, you're maybe sacrificing years of enjoyment, you know, years of a satisfied life that you would be able to enjoy were you to have those kids sooner.
No doubt. Yeah. And I think another one in the lifestyle category, another mantra or rule that has become ingrained is that you should retire when you reach retirement age. Makes sense, I guess, because like it's in the name, right? Retirement age.
That's what it's
called. That's when you do it. That's when you retire.
Kind of like speed limit, Joel. Yeah. You shouldn't go faster than what the speed limit says.
I know. I'm an idiot. But when you reach full retirement age in your mid-60s, and then you can start taking Social Security funds, that's why people really have started to equate that date, that time in their lives with not working anymore. Like, they go together hand in hand, right? Well, it's also when you have access to your own retirement accounts penalty free. But that rule overlooks the fact that we all have different goals. You know, Warren Buffett, Matt, right. he's still working at the age of 91.
Oh,
he
yeah.
did not take that retirement date up on its promise.
He's like, required minimum distributions.
I laugh in the face of those. But he's working because he gets a kick out of it. Like, yeah. he enjoys it. It's obviously not because he needs more money, right? And so, yeah, there's no need to stop working if you love what you do. You can keep working as long as you want. Others find that retiring a whole lot sooner works best for them, right? Some of our friends in the FIRE movement, they have found that not working past the age of 35 or 40 has been great for them, and they've gotten to pursue other things that they love just as much, and they haven't had to worry about providing an income for themselves, you know, for decades where most people do have to work. We would say just don't let that arbitrary date define like when you decide to take extended breaks from work or ultimately when you decide to hang it up. Like, there's no magical rule that says that at 59 and a half or at 66, like either of those dates, they are magical from the fact that you can take money from your retirement accounts or that you have reached full Social Security age. But they're not magical from the standpoint that it's a rule that you have to follow and you should really stop working at that point.
Right. I mean, basically, we want folks just to be intentional with what it is that they're doing. It's a good number to be aware of because, yeah, there are laws that govern the withdrawal of funds from your retirement accounts, but that doesn't mean that you personally are necessarily ready for retirement. There are a lot of other things that you also want to keep in mind. And so, Joel, there are also a lot of rules in the area of debt, paying off debt. I feel like it's fraught with the different things that you're supposed to do, things you should do, things you shouldn't do.
Rules to obey.
Yeah, some of those rules are helpful, others aren't. And one of these things, just generally speaking, in regards to debt, there's just a whole group of folks out there who feel that, you know, being debt-free, like, that's the way to be. Or they kind of take the mantra that, like, debt is dumb.
And that's the rule. Like, don't take on debt or you're an idiot.
No matter what. And, you know, we would ask the question, like, is that actually a good goal to have? You know, is this a decent rule to live by? We do feel that there are what we would call worse rules out there, for sure, because we're not fans of debt. We'd love to see How to Money listeners paying off their debts quickly. Lots of folks, for instance, prize having that paid off mortgage. There's nothing inherently wrong with not having any debt. But we believe that the responsible use of debt in your life can be an approach that makes a ton of sense for a lot of folks. If you have your eyes open and you know what you're doing, oftentimes it comes down to what you are planning to do with that money instead of paying it down, you know, towards that mortgage payment. And so we just wanted to mention that there are times when, you know, debt makes sense. And we talked about that back in episode 141. And again, it comes down to being intentional with that money, right? Yeah. Because if you want to say, I want to get rid of all of debt in my life because I am really going to benefit from the psychological peace that that's going to be able to bring me. Well, that's great. Do it for that reason. Or if you're like, well, I don't really care if I have debt. Well, what can I do instead with that money? Well, if you're going to take that money and then invest it, well, then you're utilizing leverage in order to see a higher return on your investment versus that money that's going towards that mortgage.
Which can burn you depending on what sort of leverage you're taking on.
You know, oh, totally. You don't want to over leverage.
Yeah. And that's a reason why, Matt, like, if we're talking about credit cards, that's one thing. But if we're talking about mortgage debt, that's another, right? And so, like, paying off your mortgage, there's a reason why it's number 7. It's on the 7th money gear out of 7 money gears. Yep. Like, there are all these other things you want to do before that. That really takes, like, last precedence. If you're talking about really low interest rate debt like a mortgage, there are a lot of smart people holding on to that mortgage so that they can do better things with that money, right? And speaking of credit cards, I think that's another rule that we should bring up when it comes to debt, is that credit cards are the devil. And I can just imagine, you remember the water boy? I can imagine.
Foosball!
Foosball is the devil, Bobby Boucher. Yes. I can imagine his mom saying the same thing about credit cards. But yeah, you know, we're all for moderated, intelligent usage of credit cards, right? Utilizing the benefits that they offer and never paying the credit card company's interest on purchases that you're making, but avoiding credit cards altogether. Well, that's a rule that isn't worth following unless you know yourself that it's not going to end up well for you. Like, if you know your own behavioral tendencies and it's like, you know, if I got a credit card in my life, I wouldn't be able to handle it, then it's probably a rule that you should never break. But for most How to Money listeners, they can break that rule and break it frequently because they're paying their balances off in full on time at the end of the billing cycle.
Yeah, honestly, I guess we just trust our listeners more, right? Because essentially we're trusting you to be an adult and to make the wise, informed decision based on what you know about yourself. I think that's a big reason why these rules we feel can be bent a little bit.
Yeah.
And again, in our case, I mean, the reason we talk about credit cards so much is because, first of all, I mean, the benefits are real, right? I mean, we're talking about serious cash back. We're talking about serious sign-up bonuses that you get, serious protections that you get as a consumer when you use those cards. But secondly, and you touched on this, Joel, but I mean, I have not paid a single cent in interest ever to a credit card company.
Same.
Like, I know myself, and same with you. And so because of that, these are benefits that we have a little more flexibility, a little more freedom around. We're not as concerned about the temptation to spend. For us, it's just not something we have to wrestle with. And when you have a bunch of debt, how you go about paying that debt off is another rule that you'll often hear. For instance, the debt snowball method is the most effective way to pay down debt. Well, not necessarily, right? That's a rule that you often hear. And we actually did an episode about the debt snowball approach versus going the avalanche route. And we kind of came down somewhere in the middle. The avalanche route is best for paying the least overall amount in interest, but it doesn't have the that helpful psychological component of picking off your smallest debts quickly, which gives you momentum. And so we kind of prefer the both and approach, you know? And so if the interest rates are similar, go with the smallest balance, because then you'll, you know, realize some of that psychological momentum.
Hey, you clear a hurdle by knocking off a balance that's really small.
Yeah,
and it's like,
exactly,
it gives you the fortitude to keep pressing on.
Sure, yeah. But if you've got a car loan, say maybe just at 4%, but then you also have credit card debt, say at 19 or 20%, you'd be crazy to pay off that car loan first. And so that's an instance where you need to actually look at what you've got going on. There is no clear black or white answer when it comes to a lot of things in life, including when it comes to paying down your debt. And so those are a few rules that affect not only our lifestyle, but how it is that we go about paying and interacting with our debts. And so, Joel, we've got a few other areas, a few other ways that we handle our money, and we're going to talk about some of the rules that pertain to those aspects of our personal finances, and we'll get to those right after this break.
We are back, and Matt, let's keep talking about some of the crappier personal finance rules and
sure.
how we can break them. I'm trying to think of, have you done the milk crate challenge? I've seen that going around. We want to break them.
No,
like,
I haven't done the milk crate challenge.
Me neither.
Well, first of all, where do people
Not
find all these milk crates?
Either. I don't know. Where do you
it's
get
It's like,
them?
First, I mean, I didn't think those were, what am I thinking of? I'm thinking of like the old post office mail crates. I remember I used to work at a camp.
Those would be safer, I think, than the...
Well, no, those were made of like this kind of plastic thing. But even still, you weren't supposed to hang
right.
on to them.
No, those would be worse.
Like,
yeah.
They're like, this is government property. I'm like, where do these people get all these milk crates? I guess a lot of folks working at Aldi or something.
Yeah, maybe. But
they got that hookup from Lidl.
We want to smash some of these personal finance rules the way people are smashing their bodies as they fall off this pile of milk crates. But yeah, we just talked about some of the rules that shape our lifestyle, how we pursue the meaningful events in our lives, and how sometimes those hold us back from doing the things that we want because there are these ingrained rules that we listen to. And the same when it comes to debt and debt payoff. We believe these things without questioning them. And if we were to question them, we'd be able to maybe proceed in a different way that would be better for our lives. Now let's shift to like saving and investing, Matt, and some of the rules that define those areas that we think are off base. And let's specifically talk about emergency funds for a second. There are quite a few rules that we think have some bend to them in this arena. You know, you and I, we've done our fair share of talking about emergency funds and the priority that they should take in your financial life. We think they're important. They provide a lot of stability for people. It's nice to know that if the crap hits the fan, that you've got money in the bank account to back you up. But there are more ways than just one to skin a cat. And the rule that many financial experts give is that you should have 6 months of savings on hand to combat a potential emergency. Some go further and they make their rule 12 months of cash on hand, which honestly I feel like is actually kind of demoralizing for most people, because they're like, how in the world am I ever going to get to that? I mean, I remember thinking that in my early 20s, mm-hmm. like,
that's a lot of money.
That feels impossible. I've got all these other things to do. What you're saying is going to take me 8 years to achieve. But yeah, there are other ways that you can have access to emergency cash without running up the credit cards, right? And maybe we should consider some of these other avenues as opposed to just having ridiculous amount of money in savings.
Totally. Yeah. So having a HELOC, a home equity line of credit, as a backup, that's one way to make this rule more of a helpful recommendation that you can do without if you so choose. HELOCs are great backup emergency funds because they usually cost $0 to set up, and you don't pay interest on that money unless you make a withdrawal. So this is only available for homeowners, obviously, but it could be worthwhile to have a HELOC backup in case, just kind of sitting there in the wings. That way you can retain a smaller emergency fund. But know that this is only something that we would recommend if you're trying to invest more of your money. Basically, we want you to do smart things with your money, not have less cash on hand so that you can blow that money, so that you can spend it and absorb it into your lifestyle.
I'm trying to go to Tahiti, so I'm going to blow my emergency fund and have the HELOC as the backup.
Just in case.
That's unwise.
Yeah, and even with that, we still think that a good minimum emergency fund goal of 3 months worth of expenses on hand is important. But even still, it's worth mentioning that HELOCs, and we saw this with the pandemic last spring, but some banks actually stopped offering those products because they're riskier. And so it's important to keep that in mind, that they may not always be available if you're like, you know what, I'm just going to get myself a new HELOC. Because it's important to keep in mind, too, that sometimes they only are available to you for like 5 or 10 years, at which point they basically expire. So they kind of have a shelf life. And if you'd been counting on that HELOC as your emergency fund and it kind of disappeared, and all of a sudden you might be sitting without that money in the bank and without a product to rely on if you needed it.
Yeah. And Matt, another question that we get when it comes to emergency funds, people want to know if they can invest it. And usually, you know, we're saying, no. For, in particular, 3 months worth of expenses, that money needs to stay in your savings account. For us, that is a hard and fast rule. But when it comes to that 6 to 12 month realm that a lot of other people talk about, we think that you can invest some of that emergency fund. And in particular, it needs to be in a Roth IRA that allows, it can act as another buffer, which can let you roll with that smaller bucket of savings, as opposed to feeling like you have to have this fully funded enormous emergency fund. And if you've been maxing out a Roth over, let's say, the last 5 years, then this should provide you with a really nice backstop, allowing you to feel a whole lot more comfortable having less cash in your account. It's still ideal, of course, to not take money out of your Roth. Like, you want to tap your savings money in the case of an emergency first, not the money you have invested in the Roth. In a perfect world, you put money in the Roth and you never touch it until you reach retirement age.
Exactly.
You know, when you're, whether you're still working or not. And then, if you need to tap those Roth funds, it's important to only take out the contributions, not the earnings, because that's what you have access to tax and penalty free. But a Roth that you have been consistently funding and it's been growing across the years can allow you to skirt that hefty e-fund rule. Unspent HSA dollars, that's another place, Matt, that people can look to, I think, that that money that's been growing consistently over the years can provide similar peace of mind, allowing you to have less money in savings. And you've got the receipts for some of those healthcare procedures that you've had done, yet you've left that money growing in the HSA. Well, when an emergency comes along, you can grab that money from the HSA and pull it out. They're just like this really flexible account that, if used well, can act as a helpful e-fund backup. So yeah, the 6 to 12 month figure, like, I get why people say that. It's really hard for most people to achieve. And using some of these other ways to kind of use as a backstop for a smaller e-fund, I think, can make a lot of sense.
That's right. And so when it comes to, so that's saving, right? We're talking about emergency funds. When it comes to investing, a rule that we often hear is you should be saving. You should be investing 15% of your paycheck. And this is actually a rule that you've heard on this show before. Because
are we going to break our own rules?
We kind of are here.
That is like the height of anarchy. I appreciate that about us.
We believe that this is a great goal for most folks to aim for. Because only putting aside 10% of your income over your entire working life, that probably isn't going to be quite enough to provide the financial security that we think most folks should be aiming for. But we're going to break our own rule here. Let's say that you're one of those overachieving Coast Fire folks who's been maxing out their retirement accounts for a decade or longer. Maybe even, you know, maybe potentially you've been saving and investing, say, 50% of your salary. So now you might be asking, can you cut back? Save only 5 to 10% of maybe what you're bringing in? Sure. You've already done the hard work of putting aside massive amounts of your earnings earlier in your life. And so putting aside 15% of what you make each year is a great goal, but doing a little more or less, depending on your specific near-term goals, is okay as well. And again, I don't want to kind of gloss over the saving more side of it. 15% is great, but if you can save 25, 35% of your income, that's even better. We don't want you to think that just because there's this rule of, oh, you should be shooting for 15%, that doesn't mean you can't save more. You should be, you know, shooting for at least 15%.
Yeah, we don't want to set the bar too low for How to Money listeners who are energized to save more. And,
right.
And ultimately what happens, Matt, the more you're able to save at younger ages, the more options you open up for yourself later on down the line. And for many of us, we don't know what the future holds. Like, we don't know what it's going to look like family-wise. We don't know how our goals are going to change. A job that we like now might be a job that we don't like a few years from now. And so the more we save, the more flexibility we really are setting ourselves up for later on down the line. Another rule when it comes to investing is don't buy single stocks and don't speculate. And in particular, I think people are saying don't speculate on cryptocurrency right now. Mm-hmm. And you'll hear this rule a lot. And it's a rule that we mostly like and also follow. But breaking this rule in small ways is fine and actually potentially a smart move, because if you keep those investments, the super speculative or single stock investments, to 5% of your portfolio or less, you know, blowing off some steam by doing small amounts of trading in that way, that can be smart if it allows you to stay the course with the massive chunk of your money and sticking to index funds, which is our favorite approach to investing, with 95% of your long-term dough. Sometimes just dabbling with that can actually provide the mental fortuity to kind of stick to it with the other stuff, do the boring stuff. If you have just like a little bit of that exposure to the investing excitement that usually actually leads to regret for most people, but it is one of those ways, I think, which you can learn a lesson if you're doing too much of it, but doing it in small amounts, I think, really isn't that big of a deal. And so that's a rule that it can be broken, at least in a small way.
That's right. Another rule that we've often heard is that if you love your kids, you'll start saving for their college now.
That's why I tell my kids that I don't love them, Matt.
Because I am not saving for your college. Now you know. No, this rule was definitely made to be broken because there are so many ways to pay for college, but there are only a couple ways when it comes to funding your retirement. And so this should be a much lower priority for most parents. You know, all that to say, we're not anti-529 accounts, but we do think that you should only open one if you're in money gear number 7 and you're already crushing it with your own personal money goals. And remember that not funding their college costs from the day that they're, you know, that they're born, that does not mean that you love them any less.
So I can start telling my kids
contrary
that
to what
Joel's
saying.
Yeah?
Yeah, you can.
Good. Okay. All right. I'll tell them when I get home.
Tell them tonight.
They'll be so glad to hear it. I agree, Matt. I think that's another money gear number 7 thing. You know, we talked about paying off the mortgage, saving for your kids' college. Like, those are decent goals to have, but they're goals that you have once you reach an immense amount of financial stability, not earlier on in the process. And it's not a hard and fast rule either. You're more than welcome, once you get to Money Gear 7, to do all sorts of other things instead of saving for your kids' college, if you want.
Or saving and investing at all. I mean, if your larger money goals have to do with spending a lot more money, that's up to you.
Yeah.
You know, as long as you've taken care of those other steps, you're kind of free to do whatever you want.
Exactly. Yeah. And there's some financial rules that feel like they're a bit more rigid than others. Like earlier, we were talking about the Roth IRA. And you might know that in 2021, a single tax filer needs to have a modified adjusted gross income of $140,000 or less in order to be able to contribute to one. And married filing jointly, your Maggie needs to be less than $208,000, right? But even when it comes to the IRS, there are ways that you can bend and actually break these rules. Make sure you kind of know the tax rules around the backdoor Roth, but yeah, there are no income limits when it comes to doing these conversions. So this is what people refer to commonly as the backdoor Roth. And this is how you would go about allowing your contributions and earnings to grow tax-free. So there's this rule that we've all heard, Matt, that says if you make over a certain amount of money, you can't contribute to the Roth IRA, which is an account that you and I, we love and we've sung the praises of over the years. But it turns out that rule can be broken if you're doing a backdoor Roth, which is not nearly as publicized and not many people know about it, but it allows you access to putting money into a Roth account, which can be really, really helpful from a tax planning perspective. You just kind of want to make sure you know all the details before you jump in. So hopefully we just smashed a few investing rules maybe that you had in your mind that aren't as helpful as maybe previously thought. We've got preventing you from doing something that you should be doing with your money when you've really wanted to, but you're like, the rules say I shouldn't. And we want to give you the freedom to kind of fight back against some of those limiting rules. But let's get to some more rules, Matt, in particular about spending and earning. We'll get to some rules that are maybe holding us back in those realms right after this.
All right, we are back from the break. We're talking about some of the different financial rules that we come across and why it is that we think you should be breaking these rules. And Joel, you know, I was thinking about why it is that we're drawn to rules. And it's because it's easy. It's easy to point to something that you know you are allowed to do. It's either yes or no. It's binary, right? It's yes or no, black or white, correct or incorrect. And folks don't like landing in that in-between no man's land.
The shades of gray.
The land of nuance.
Yeah.
And that's what we try to do, honestly, with our show overall. But specifically with this episode, we're kind of diving into the additional questions that should come after you hear one of these rules, where it's just like, well, maybe, like, you should also consider this and this. There are other ways to accomplish these goals that we're trying to achieve.
Yeah, and let's be honest, too. The people that, the voices that get amplified the most in our culture are the black and white voices.
Oh, yeah.
They are the most extremes, mm-hmm. Really, in the world of politics, in the world of money. Like,
I knew you were going to take it there.
they are. And
it's
so
true, though.
The people that we hear from, you feel you're almost like forced into one of these two camps. But really, when you look at even like political statistics, most Americans identify as independents. Like, they don't identify as being fully with one party or the other. They don't identify on the extremes. And I think in money, it's the same way. There are a lot of people who hear maybe the more stringent types or the really incredibly loose liberal types with money. And they're like, I don't know, man. Neither of those really fits me. And so while we might not be the most amplified voices, like, we're going to use our platform to say, no, there is a gray area here. Some of these rules are made to be broken, but you still need to be smart with your money.
That's right. We're bringing that moderate, nuanced conversation to personal finance, to money. Hopefully we'll see a trickle-down effect. That's another political reference.
We're like the Ross Perot of personal finance.
All right, let's talk about some classic spending rules that
For our Gen Z listeners, I don't think they know.
They don't know who Ross Perot
is. Do they know Ross Perot? All right, maybe we'll link to like his Wikipedia page in our show notes.
But we wanted to talk about some different spending rules that we often hear about in the personal finance realm, and we're going to bust up some of these rules. The first one we're going to tackle is that you must have a budget. Now, of course, I specifically am a huge fan of budgets, but that doesn't mean that everyone must have one. Most folks...
I know it pains you even to say that.
Okay, so it really does pain me to say that, because I kind of feel that anybody would benefit from a budget, because someone who's maybe an oversaver, they're incredibly frugal, well, it could free them up to spend a little bit more, a little more freely, with a little more intention. And somebody who is an overspender, they don't have, you know, they got a lot more month than they do money. I think if they were to budget, then they're going to be able to maybe achieve some of those financial goals. And I think that's for the overwhelming majority of folks. But I do think that there are some naturally frugal folks who don't necessarily have to be beholden to a budget. And so if there's someone out there who's investing a healthy, good chunk of money in their retirement accounts, automatically, maybe you've got a healthy savings account, maybe you're naturally averse to spending an overwhelming amount of money, well, you might fit into that category of a person who can stop budgeting. Especially, I think, if you find it to be a painful process and instead you're able to just naturally achieve the goals that you're trying to achieve, you're naturally able to spend with a plan, without a written plan, then I think that's the kind of person who doesn't have to have a budget. But again, that being said, I think most folks could benefit one way or the other from having a written budget.
Yeah, it is a rule that can be broken, but I agree, Matt. I think it is a helpful tool for most people. I was listening to friend of the show Daniel Crosby talk about budgets recently, and he's one of those guys who's like, I can't do it, and I hate it, and so I'm not going to. And he can afford not to, because he's done really good things with his money over a long enough period of time that he doesn't have to pigeonhole himself into the classic budgeting trope that he has to have one of those in his life. And so, you know, I appreciate that. I used to roll without a budget until I got married, and then it was like, actually, it's a necessary communication tool for my wife and I.
Yeah.
But it is one of those things where I agree. It is a rule that people feel like, even if they're really, really good with money, that they have to do. And we think there are ways that you can make budgeting less miserable, too. We've talked about that before, and we will continue to talk about why budgeting does not have to be an awful thing in your life. But also know that it is not a requirement to be a part of the personal finance community.
Sure.
And Matt, another spending rule that constantly gets thrust at people is that they should always be getting a deal. This used to be me too, right? Like, I've talked about this on the show, that paying full price was kind of anathema to who I was. Like, it was, I was like, there's no way I could ever pay full price for anything. And yeah, I took deal hunting to the extreme. I still personally prefer not to pay full price for something. Like I hear some people in the personal finance world say, I only pay full price for things because it helps me not fall prey to this lifestyle of like deal hunting. And I get that. I understand it. But I feel like I've been able to realize the error of my deal obsessed ways and like not do as much deal hunting and actually keeping it to a minimum. Because yeah, really the best deal isn't 30, 40, 50% off. It is getting something at 100% off by not getting that thing at all.
By avoiding it altogether. That's yeah. Right.
And like you only get that when you stop shopping, when you shop less. Buying fewer, nicer things also can lead to more enjoyment of those things. I've realized that too, is that I just had more things, too many things, and clutter. And yeah, so if you're living by the rule that big discounts are king, then you likely need to kick that one to the curb because it's probably hurting more than it's helping you.
If you want, we can set up some sort of accountability and I can see how often you're actually visiting Slick Deals or Deal News.
Let's do it.
If you want me to really hold you accountable. Let's talk about splurges, man. There's this rule out there that if you're in debt, you have to stop spending on anything that you enjoy. And again, let's go ahead and side with that rule here for a second. Debt is not ideal. We do encourage How to Money listeners to create a plan to attempt to pay down their debt quickly. You know, whether it's the snowball or the avalanche approach,
middle of the road approach that we love.
Oh yeah, both and approach. We want you to choose just the approach that's going to help you to get there faster. And one of the reasons for that is because debt actually makes us dumber. We've talked about the studies that show that the stress that debt causes to our bodies. Has an impact on our IQ.
It's something like 12 IQ points that you lose when you're, you know, overwhelmed with debt.
Exactly. So the quicker that you're done with debt, the better off that you're going to be from a mental health perspective. And so that means getting rid of it quickly. That should be a top priority. But if it took you years to get into that debt conundrum in the first place, it'll likely take you years to get out of it. And it is hard to live an austere monastic existence for years and years. And so make sure that you still include a few important spending items within your budget so that you don't get burned out while you're pursuing debt elimination. You still want to have those craft beer equivalents in your life to kind of carry over from day to day, from week to week, whatever it is that you're going to splurge on just a little bit. And you can even kind of set those up as little rewards, maybe as you're chiseling away or as you're chipping away at your debt. You can have these little rewards that spur you on to achieve your goal even faster.
No doubt, man. All right, yeah, and there are also some, you just talked about spending rules. Let's talk about some well-defined rules in the arena of earning more money and that we really kind of take as stock or standard. But there's room for pushback on these rules too. And I think, Matt, one of the biggest rules out there is that you need to go to college in order to get a high-paying job.
And pretty classic rule.
That is a classic rule, right?
My parents told me, definitely fed me that rule like my entire, I mean, I think ever since I was a kid.
I don't think I knew there were alternatives to going to college.
Oh, no. It was, I mean, basically, okay, so I will say, my dad, we did have a conversation, I think when I was like a sophomore or something like that in high school. And he's just like, you know, you don't have to go to college. But mom would be devastated.
She would stop loving you. And you're like, I guess I'll do it.
He totally put that out there. And I was just like, okay, well, I mean, college sounds cool. You know,
yeah.
Like, you see movies about college. I was kind of, I think, more into it from like a lifestyle standpoint. It's just like, yeah, that's just what all my friends are doing. I didn't have a whole lot of drive, I would say. Yeah, as a high schooler, I'm like, everybody else is doing it. I'll do it too.
You're the follow the crowd kind of guy.
Oh, I definitely was then.
Well, yeah, the last decade though, really, since we went to college, we've kind of seen this rule disintegrate before our very eyes. Like
right. The
reality that getting a college degree automatically equates to a high-paying job, it's not the case like it used to be. And it's not like getting an advanced degree doesn't still work out for lots of folks, but it's just the value proposition has changed in a big way. It's not a slam dunk like it was when we were younger, and in particular, our parents' generation too, right? And COVID has likely hurt that value proposition even more. Like, you might not be getting the same experience on a college campus these days, and in all likelihood, you're not. And so, yeah, it's more important than ever to do the math yourself and to run the numbers with your kids before blindly believing that college is the essential move and that it, of course, it makes sense. At its core, the decision to go to college or not is an investment decision, and not that there aren't lifestyle benefits, right, to going. But if it means inundating your kids or yourself with copious amounts of debt that you can never pay off, then it's not worth even that social experience that you were able to gather. You can get that in other ways. And it's also important to remember that blue collar jobs are seeing a revival right now, and they're seeing higher amounts of pay, and rightly so, because we haven't incentivized people to go in that direction. We talked about more about that in episode 277 with Ken Rusk. And so, yeah, if you kind of feel inclined towards working with your hands anyway or being entrepreneurial, don't assume that you have to go to college. I mean, we still think it's a great idea for a lot of people. And even in that decision, you have to be really smart so that you're getting a degree that's going to pay off for you and so that you're not taking on more debt than you're going to be able to handle. But yeah, that rule that says college equals great job just doesn't hold water the way it used to.
That's right, man. It'll be really interesting to see where things are when our oldest kids start going to college, to see if it's things shift, honestly, between now and then, or if they kind of continue at the rate that they've been. We're talking about earning money, and so what kind of while we're on that note, let's talk about replacement of income. Let's talk about life insurance. And the rule that you'll often hear when you're shopping around for life insurance is that you need to have a policy that can cover 10 times your income, which, you know, that's not a bad rule, but it certainly is not one that you have to follow. Joel and I, we actually both just got new policies, new life insurance policies, and many insurance salespeople, they're going to kind of frown when you don't have a policy that's 10x your annual income.
Yeah, and they will try to convince you.
Yeah, they will. I mean, it's in their best interest to kind of upsell you a little bit. But there are other factors that you can take into account. Things like other sources of income. That's real estate for you and me, Joel. Also, how close you are to actually achieving financial independence. Some of the different responsibilities that you have, depending on the number of kids you have, the different liabilities. These are all things that you want to keep in mind. Not, you don't just want to blindly follow the rule of, oh, you must have 10x your current income. And so if you're further along that road, say, towards financial independence, you know, there's no necessity to stick hard to this 10x income rule. And also just remember too, having some life insurance coverage is better than just not having anything at all.
Yeah, and when I think sometimes people hear the 10x and they get the price quotes and they're like, oh, that's gonna be a bigger chunk of my monthly budget than I wanted it to be. And so they settle for, you know, a smaller policy. And I think having something, you can always get another policy down the road and you can do what's called laddering, right? And so if you're turned away by the price, although term life insurance, incredibly cheap. Like,
yeah.
Hopefully you're not turned away by the price because it really shouldn't be too terribly expensive. But you might say, you know what, I'm going to get half as much as the life insurance industry says I should get, and I will have some coverage at least, because you're right, something is better than nothing. But rules, Matt, in summation, rules can be great. And you're right, they often help point us in the right direction. Without rules, we can be lost. And breaking rules without giving any thought as to why you're doing so is more of a recipe for some catastrophic mistakes. Mm-hmm. And but I think there's like the letter of the law and then there's the spirit of the law, Matt, right? For instance, going back to that speed limit example, most policemen are not supposed to pull you over unless you're going 10 miles an hour over the speed limit, right? It is this limit that you're supposed to adhere to, but there's a grace range for you even in that. And also there's something to be said for driving with the flow of traffic. And as you grow in your financial education, you're likely going to find other points in time where you can bend or break a rule that you've heard because your specific situation, it needs a different tactic. And so it's important to know the fundamentals before you start improvising, right? Like a jazz musician, before they can get crazy with their music, they have to know their scales and they have to know them really well. But knowing that it's okay to break some of these rules, I think it can be freeing too. And so, our advice to you guys is to go break some of these rules. Like don't go haywire, but some of these rules really, they're helpful to know, but then they're not meant to be followed blindly.
That's right, man. Let's go ahead and get back to the beer that you and I enjoyed on this episode, which was called Indefinite Staycation. And this was a barrel-aged fruited sour ale by Dogfish Head. Before we talk about the beer, hold this bottle. Do you realize how heavy this thing is?
Oh, that's a heavy
bottle.
That
is not a normal weighted glass bottle. And I guess it's because since this was one that was, I assume, bottle conditioned and it was corked and caged, they're maybe worried about the pressure. I don't know. But it is like twice as thick as a normal bottle. It's just this little guy, but he's got weight that's at least twice the size of what it looks like it should be. That just kind of caught me off guard here when I picked it up. But what were your thoughts on this actual beer?
Well, first, I like the name, except for it feels like Indefinite Staycation feels like our lives.
That is not what we want
months,
right now.
Right? Yeah. I want Indefinite Vacation. No. But yeah, I think this beer was worth the 2-year wait that it took to make this beer. This beer was aged for over 2 years in French oak, and the it had, I don't think we mentioned, it had blackberries and wild Maine blueberries in this beer. And so it had just delicious levels of fruitiness, delicious levels of like oak presence, a little bit of funkiness. I love fruited sours, and this one goes in like the pantheon of the greats of great fruited sours. I think it was nice. Really delicious.
Yeah, it was really good, dude. I agree. It was incredibly acidic. I feel like that's the first thing I noticed when I took my first sip. Like, I noticed the acid, and then then right after that, I noticed like the wood notes. You kind of have like those, like the sharp sour, and then it fades into the kind of the fruit sweetness going on. That sweetness really kind of broke through there, I feel like, on the end. And you know, earlier I was telling you the story about how Kate and I went hiking. Well, during one of our hikes, we actually, like, at the top of, like, near Mount Mitchell, we came across a bunch of wild blueberries and blackberries. I'm not even kidding. I actually have maybe I'll post another photo.
You should make your own beer that rivals this.
Well, here's the thing. Mount Mitchell, it's the highest peak east of the Mississippi. And so Kate was saying that she's pretty sure that these are the same kind of blueberries that grow wild in Maine. And because it was at such a high elevation, normally you don't see these blueberries in North Carolina, but where we were hiking, you do. And so I kind of feel like it came full circle. But yeah, this was a really great beer. And thanks again to Ryan for donating this one to the show.
Yeah, thanks, Ryan. Appreciate you, man. And we appreciate Dogfish Head, man. They've been making good beer for decades now. So, all right, that's going to do it for this episode. For folks who want the show notes with any links, including that Ross Perot Wikipedia page, we'll put that on there for all you Gen Zers who don't remember who he was. You can find those up on our website at howtomoney.com.
That's right. And if you have not subscribed to the show yet, we would love it if you mashed subscribe so you don't miss any future episodes. If you haven't left us a review yet, we would greatly appreciate that, especially over at Apple Podcasts.
And you can also take your grandma's phone and mash subscribe to.
She wants to hear us talk about craft beer.
Yeah, she does.
At the end of the episode. Joel, that's going to be it for this episode. Until next time.
Best friends out.
Best friends out.